Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, I'm Dr. Robert Pearl, former CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Kaiser Permanente, a Stanford Medical and Business School professor, a Forbes contributor and best-selling author of the book Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong.
And I am Jeremy Corr, host of the New Books in Medicine podcast. American healthcare is broken. Across the United States, there are over 200,000 patient deaths from medical error every year, growing physician burnout, outdated technology, and inconvenient and delayed care for patients. And on top of all of this, skyrocketing drug prices and increasingly unaffordable out-of-pocket patient expenses. For decades, our nation's political and medical leaders have talked about fixing the American healthcare system, and yet the problems are now greater than in the past.
Every other industry that is inefficient and ineffective has experienced disruption. Healthcare will be no different. The question is whether the solutions will come from inside the healthcare system or be imposed on it. We'd like to invite you to listen to our new podcast, Fixing Healthcare with Dr. Robert Pearl and Jeremy Corr. Each episode will feature one of the top leaders and innovative thinkers in healthcare today. The show's format is simple. The guests will present a roadmap for fixing American healthcare's biggest problems. And from there, Jeremy and I will scrutinize the plan and help listeners separate fixes that have the potential to succeed from simply the hype.
Our goal is that everyone from healthcare consumers to political and medical leaders will find value in the discussions on our show. You may not agree with the different solutions offered, but you will never again conclude that nothing can be done. We hope you will join us. Please subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcast software. For more information, visit our website at www.fixinghealthcarepodcast.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Medicine. I am your host, Jeremy Corr. Today, we will be talking to one of the top and most decorated neurologists in the world, Dr. Andrew Lees. He is a professor of neurology at the National Hospital for Neurosurgery and Neurology in Queen Square, London, and the University College London. In 2011, he was named as the world's most highly cited Parkinson's disease researcher. He is here today to talk about his book, Mentored by a Madman, The William Burroughs Experiment. This is a book that provides a fascinating insight into the career of Dr. Lees, one of the most brilliant minds in the field of neurology. Dr. Andrew Lees, welcome to the show. It is an absolute pleasure to be speaking with you today.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Andrew, I wonder if you could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself. In the book, you say that you originally wanted to be a botanist. How did you end up a neurologist and where you are today?
Yes, well, as a child, I didn't play doctors and nurses, and I don't think I had any more empathy than any of my peers. Nobody in my family was a doctor. In England at that time, medicine was a bit of a dynastic speciality. It's changed a lot now. But at that time, if your father was a doctor, you often ended up being a doctor too. But there was nobody at all in my family with a medical degree. And as a teenager, I got very interested in natural history, particularly botany, but also entomology and ornithology too. And I joined the local natural history club in the north of England where I was born. And I when I was, my parents at that time suggested that there wasn't much opportunities to be a professional botanist, and there was only David Attenborough was already very famous in England, and perhaps had the market as the only one. So I think it was, although I resented the advice at the time, I think it was very wise advice. I think there may be more opportunities now for botanical research and botanical field work and so on than there was then. So they kind of gently nudged me towards medicine. And in my interview at the medical school in London, I was asked I told them I was very interested in natural history, and they said, how do you think that would help you to be a good doctor? And at the time, of course, I said, many medicines come from plants, and the study of plants and materia medica was actually a speciality in the past that was part of the training of every medical student. It's now subsumed under clinical pharmacology. But when I look back now, I mean, I think what botany taught me, even though studying the anatomy of flowers and the function of flowers and plants has no direct relevance to the study of human disease, what the discipline taught me was to observe very meticulously and very carefully. It increased my powers of observation. And equally importantly, it encouraged me to record in detail what I saw. And these are very basic skills for medicine, even in the days of computers and so on. We need to, certainly in neurology is very much a visual art, so that many fully established neurological diseases you can pick up on the tube or in the street. It's a visual speciality, and the powers of observation remain very, very important eliciting physical signs. So I think that was the sort of connection. And of course, I mean, medicine is not medicine. I always think of medicine as a sort of intermediary. It's between art and science. It's really the art of healing is, of course, an art, but we depend very heavily on science for the understanding of mechanisms of disease. So an interest in natural history and biology fits nicely in the middle there. It's not hardcore science like physics and maths.
Right. I love that you call healing an art. I think that's really neat. So I will admit, before reading this book, I did not know a lot about William Burroughs. I knew that he was the author of Naked Lunch and had provided inspiration for both the beat movement, as well as a number of popular musicians, such as bands like Nirvana and Steely Dan. Seeing as how he is the inspiration for your book and has provided you with numerous other inspirations and intersections throughout your career, can you please tell us a bit about him?
Well, he was born in 1914 in St. Louis, Missouri. He came from a well-to-do family. His grandfather had invented the first adding machine, so he certainly didn't come from a poor background. And despite his abuse of drugs throughout most of his life, he lived to be 83 and died in 1997. I mean, he's best known, I suppose, as one of the leading lights in the what's now called the Beat Generation, along with Jack Kerouac and Allen Ginsberg, both of whom were very close friends of his when he was a young man. But later in his life, he always divorced himself from that. He didn't accept that there was a Beat movement. He felt that, those three individuals were very, very different in their outlook and their creative art, but that's how, of course, he's best remembered. And then, in comparison, I would say even to Kerouac, and certainly compared with Ginsberg, he's lasted much longer. And part of that is because he was adopted as a prophet and a guru by the punks and the post-punk generation, so that his his writing became a kind of message for a generation of musicians. And I think that that has helped him to survive longer in the public awareness right. than perhaps, certainly compared with Ginsberg. I'm not saying Ginsberg isn't remembered, but I think Burroughs' ideas and his writing has certainly more to tell us about contemporary America and the rest of the world than perhaps Kerouac or Ginsberg.
Can you please tell us what inspired you to write the book and at the same time share some of the reservations you had about writing it as well?
Well, it's a sort of dressed up memoir. I mean, I call it a fantasia, which is a bit of a literary conceit because it really is a memoir. But most doctors' memoirs are so dry and boring that I wanted to try and escape from that genre in a sense. But it is. And of course, I also wanted to write about myself. I've had a career where most doctors are not really encouraged to talk about themselves. We're taught to listen, but not to talk about ourselves, not just in a consultation, but in our publications, so that scientific writing is, of course, very dry, and it's not first person, it's third person, you know. So I was quite keen as I came towards the end of my career to write a little bit about myself. And the other reason for writing really was that I was concerned about the direction that medical research is going, and disappointed, in fact, that despite 40 years of trying to find a cure for Parkinson's disease, I felt I'd failed. And I wanted to review, in a way, why I'd failed. Was it my fault? Was it the system's fault? Why haven't we made more progress in this group of very brutal neurodegenerative disorders, which include Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, Lou Gehrig's disease, and so on? So that was a kind of another reason for writing the book. So it's not, the book's really not about the art of healing, as I mentioned. I think that's another book for another time. William Burroughs would have been a dreadful role model for anybody who wants to be a good doctor. In fact, he, you know, one of his leading characters, Doc Benway in Naked Lunch, is the antithesis of good doctoring. And he wrote a lot about bad doctors and mad doctors in his writing. So, but where he helped me really, well, he helped me in a number of ways, but I think throughout my career, the advice he gave me through his writings were very helpful in navigating the medical science, the bureaucracy and the control systems within medical science. So I think he can speak to people who are researchers much more than physicians, really. And my job is a divided job. I spend half my week seeing patients in consulting rooms and, you know, trying to treat the sick. But the other half of the week has always been involved in trying to find new cures for Parkinson's disease. And it's that half of my professional life where I think Burroughs has been helpful to me.
When and how did you first find out about Burroughs?
Well, I studied medicine in the 60s, and of course this was the time of the countercultural movement. And in those days, all of us read the same books. It's not like now, there was no internet and there were fashionable books. And in fact, most of my peers all read the same books. And if you were a bit trendy and a bit hip, Naked Lunch was one of the books that was on the reading list. And I first actually encountered William Burroughs on the front cover of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band in 1967, the Beatles album. And being a bit of an obsessive nerd, which probably augured well for my future career in neurology, unlike most of my friends, I actually wanted to know who all those people were on the front cover. And there is no key in Sergeant Pepper's to who is on the front cover, but I managed to go find a key. And one of the people, actually, I only recognized about 20% of the people on the front cover. And so one of the 80% I didn't recognize was William Burroughs, who was simply described as a writer at that time. And it wasn't until 2 years later that at a time of actual great, I was having great difficulty with continuing my medical studies. I was quite disillusioned. Some of the things I was seeing in the hospital, I found quite shocking. Some of the things we were expected to do, I rebelled a little bit against. And it was at that point that I was actually given Naked Lunch by a friend to read. And I entered into a sort of metaphorical Faustian bargain with William Burroughs after I'd read Naked Lunch. And he said to me, provided you listen to what I have to say, I'll let you complete your medical studies. Of course, this is metaphorical, of course. It's not, right. It didn't actually happen. But so I stuck to, you know, there was a real danger at that time that I could have flunked my exams and given up medicine. So I see him as a kind of savior, really, in a curious sort of way. So that I got through my exams, and I did try and keep my bargain. So since then, over the next 30 years, I've read Naked Lunch several times, and I've read really virtually all the whole Burroughs canon, and there's quite an extensive literature. He wrote many books other than Naked Lunch, a lot of essays. And of course, in his later life, he became quite a public performer. He was a great reader with his St. Louis drawl. And he would read at not just at universities, but at literary and pop festivals, and was adopted by a younger generation. So there's a lot. For people who don't know about Burroughs and want to be introduced to him, maybe one way of getting introduced to him is to go on YouTube, you know, first of all, and look at the many readings and interviews that are available there.
You know, you mentioned earlier Burroughs had an interesting view of and relationship with doctors. He even originally wanted to become a doctor. Can you please share you know, how doctors were portrayed in his work, and what made, you know, his character of Dr. Benway that you previously mentioned stand out so much to you?
Yeah, well, he read English literature at Harvard, but I don't think he attended many of the lectures. He was one of these students who made his own curriculum up. So he was academic. I mean, he was very well read. But he read a lot of anthropology and a lot of magic while he was at Harvard. And when he left Harvard, he also did a postgraduate course at Columbia in anthropology and remained, I think, very interested in anthropology throughout his life, which is often an intro into medicine, so that we do a brief course of anthropology as part of our medical degrees. And I think when he began to realize in his 20s that he wasn't, you know, he had a few problems. Remember, he was homosexual at a time when homosexuality was a criminal offense in the United Right. States. He was attracted to a gangster lifestyle and hung around with lowlifes in New York City when he met Ginsberg and Kerouac. And it was around that time that he started to have psychoanalysis, which he had on and off for about 10 years. And about that time, he toyed with the idea himself of becoming a psychiatrist. And I can't remember exactly what it was, but there was one thing at high school that he'd not passed, which was at that time mandatory to do medical studies in the United States. And he couldn't be bothered to go back and do it. But he discovered that while he was traveling in Europe, that you could enroll for a medical degree in Vienna. And this was just before World War II. without this particular qualification. So he did actually enroll as a medical student in at the University of Vienna, but he developed, I don't think he was doing very well anyway, but he developed appendicitis and then he never went back. So, but I think then throughout his life, in a way he saw himself as a, he had a very conflicted and ambiguous relationship with doctors. In a sense, he saw himself as a doctor to his friends, his close friends. And many of, you know, Kerouac and Ginsberg, for example, were quite a bit younger than him. And he was a kind of avuncular therapeutic father figure for many of them. But his contacts with doctors were generally traumatic. So he had all this psychoanalysis, all of which he concluded was absolutely useless. Many different therapists in New York and Chicago. He also had contact with the kind of doctors who push prescriptions. So, you know, he came to see the doctor-patient relationship a bit like the pusher-patient, the pusher-junkie relationship, that these doctors were just prescribing him dope for money and were not really taking any interest in his substance dependence. So he had quite a bad experience. He encountered bad doctors, I think, early on, or at least doctors that couldn't do much to help him. And I think he then came to see doctors as a representative of control figures. And of course we are, I mean, like the police in a sense, we are members of the establishment. So I think he vented some of his spleen relating to control and control, society control on doctors. He saw doctors as people who carried on the system, you know, in that sense. And I think that explains partly his characterization of Benway. There are many other figures, but Benway's the best one. He writes a lot about different doctors. Benway, of course, I mean, one of the things that Burroughs was very frightened of was mind control. I mean, you remember that this was a period of lobotomies and electric shocks, and people with homosexuality were being treated with some of these very invasive psychiatric treatments, aversive therapy, and so on. But Burroughs was terrified of mind control. Paradoxically, people said that he would have made a very good member of the CIA if he'd been offered a job in the CIA, because he had a kind of spooky exterior to him. But he was at the same time very frightened of any form of control. And I think that led him to portray Benway as an unscrupulous, sadistic medical scientist who did experiments on his patients without consent. Right. So I expect you're wondering how somebody like this could be a mentor by medical research. So he seems and of course this was the, you know, many people have been surprised that I've had William Burroughs as a virtual mentor. In fact, I'm one of the few people who've never met him. He was like most of the Beat generation. He was incredibly open and very sociable. So if you were to knock on his door and as a complete stranger, he would let you in and he would talk to you. He was a very courteous person in that sense, a bit withdrawn and remote and silent, but the number of people I've met since I wrote the book who have actually met him is enormous. So he certainly was not somebody who hid himself away and just hung around with junkies. He was very open in that sense. So I never met him. So all this is a virtual mentorship. But some of the people who I've met, and James Grauholtz, who runs the Burroughs Estate, who kindly wrote the forward for my book, told me that, you know, that I'd got so much out of him that maybe if I'd met him, I wouldn't have got as much out of him as I did by just reading his book. So that kind of reassured me. I've always been a bit disappointed I didn't meet him, but the fact that I didn't, I think, isn't probably neither here nor there. So he, yeah, so he, yeah, that's kind of how I met him, through an indirect way.
Right, right. In the book, you also discuss that you learned a lot from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's The Complete Works of Sherlock Holmes. You even said that the Baker Street Sleuth's method of crime detection proved far greater value to you than anything you read in Lord Brain's Diseases of the Nervous System. Can you please explain this for us?
Yes, I had some very interesting teachers when I started my residency in neurology in London. One of them, Dr. William Goody, who was one of my doctor mentors. William Burroughs was my non-medical mentor, but I also, of course, had medical mentors. And for most doctors, we learn most from patients, of course. Our patients are our real mentors. That's where we get most of our, at least where I get most of my ideas for research and so on. But William Goody told me, you will learn neurology from listening to what your patients have to tell you, so pay close attention. And don't bother to read any textbooks of neurology. But what I would recommend is that you read Marcel Proust, À la recherche du temps perdu, and The Complete Works of Sherlock Holmes. Well, it took me a lot of time to finish Proust. In fact, I only finished Proust about 10 years ago. But looking back on Proust, I think Proust is a kind of neuroscientist. And for anybody... Of course, his father was a doctor, and he mingled very much through his own medical illnesses with the great neurologists of Paris in the 19th century. But if you want to know about memory, and particularly involuntary memory, you can learn a great deal from Proust. And I think also out of that, I began to learn that I could learn about medicine much more from original descriptions of disease, many of which were 19th century, and some of which actually occurred in novels rather than in medical learned textbooks, than I could by modern textbooks. The descriptions seemed to be more vivid and more alive. So that was the Proust advice. Now the Sherlock Holmes was an easier recommendation from my teacher in the sense that I'd read much of Sherlock Holmes before he was recommended to me, as many young people in England do. And each generation of young people seem to rediscover Sherlock Holmes. And as you know, he's very popular now, partly through the television series of Benedict Cumberbatch and Robert Downey. And he's survived. And of course, he didn't live. Sherlock Holmes didn't live. So he's a fictional character of Arthur Conan Doyle, who was a physician. Whereas many of the heroes of that era, David Livingstone, the British explorer and so on, are all forgotten. Young people have forgotten those great heroes of Victorian times. But Sherlock Holmes lives on. And Sherlock Holmes, the discipline of the speciality of medical legal jurisprudence, which is now called forensic medicine, developed pari passu with neurology at the end of the 19th century. So these were two new specialities that were coming into existence at around the same time. And some of the first neurologists had joint appointments in forensic medicine because of, the links between insanity and crime. Could epilepsy cause homicides and this sort of thing? So there was a parallel trajectory in that sense. But the solving of crimes, particularly of the sort that Sherlock fictional detectives do, and the great forensic scientists of the beginning of the 20th century did, bears an enormous amount of parallels with the diagnostic process in clinical neurology. Neurology is still like psychiatry and perhaps with internal medicine, is still very much a narrative-based speciality. So taking a good, careful history is still intrinsically important to the business of neurology, even now in the 21st century, with all the modern developments of technology such as imaging and so on. So unlike some aspects of medicine, for example, metabolic medicine or renal disease to a certain degree, which has been taken over by technology, neurology and psychiatry are still very much related to the history. So you have to you have to get your facts from the history. And then the neurological examination depends, as I've already mentioned, on careful powers of observation. And then you have to put it all together with a deductive, or as sometimes is said, an inferential abductive reasoning, which is what Sherlock Holmes did in his detective detecting of crime. So you can learn a great deal from that. And what interested me is that when I came to write this book, because I haven't, I mean, Sherlock Holmes, I think, is somebody who can be very helpful to neurologists in their clinical practice, in their diagnostic practice, but it's not that much use for research, apart from that you must pay attention to detail and negatives are important, pay attention to trifles, all these sorts of things, which are very important. But he's very important for clinical medicine. Whereas Burroughs, as I've already said, I found a much more helpful mentor in medical research. Now, what's interesting is that during the research for my book, I learned that Allen Ginsberg had often referred to William Burroughs as a Sherlock Holmes-like figure, which surprised me, really. But when I came to think about it, it wasn't so far from reality, because Burroughs were always dressed very, he dressed very smartly. He always wore English suits, English ties. In a way, he was very traditional in his reading matter. He read a lot of 19th century literature. He carried a gun, which Sherlock Holmes always carried a weapon. He was a misogynist, as Sherlock Holmes was, and he was quite scientific in his way of thinking. So that he, for example, in the 60s, when he became friendly with Timothy Leary, he accused Timothy Leary of being very, very unscientific, which of course was true. And Burroughs's writings about his, what I consider his self-experimentation with psychedelic drugs and other drugs, recreational drugs, was always very objective in a sense. It was almost as if he was using his own brain as a kind of petri dish to study the effects of these drugs on mind and consciousness. And when I had later on in my career, when some of the patients that we were treating with drugs for Parkinson's disease actually became dependent on the drugs, and I needed to learn up about addiction, I found reading Junkie and Burroughs' other writings about substance dependence much more instructive and informative than much of the what's sometimes unkindly called psychobabble, which is a sort of rather jargon-ridden literature related to psychology and substance dependence written by biological psychiatrists and experimental psychologists. Mm-hmm. So this may reflect a certain amount about me, but again, I found that reading Burroughs's personal accounts of addiction and his observations about what caused addiction much more instructive for me going forward with my research.
So you're world famous for your contributions to Parkinson's research. Can you please share with us a bit about L-DOPA, what it is, when you first heard of L-DOPA as a treatment for Parkinson's, and how your early work with it inspired you to focus your career on Parkinson's research and treatment?
Well, I was fortunate in the 60s was the era of neurochemistry for brain disease. And of course, this backed on to the real change away from psychoanalysis and Freud, so that brain neurochemistry was shedding light, or was thought to be shedding light, on most mental illness as well as neurological illness. So, for example, around that time, it was felt that serotonin deficiency was an important factor in causing depression. Dopamine excess was considered to be important in the causation of schizophrenia. And in particular, dopamine deficiency was found to be a very important cause for Parkinson's disease. And in the mid-60s, the first really effective treatment for Parkinson's disease became available, which was L-DOPA, which is a naturally occurring amino acid found in beans, which gets across the blood-brain barrier where it's converted into dopamine. So it's a sort of top-up for the deficient dopamine in the brain. You can't give dopamine itself, because dopamine doesn't get across the blood-brain barrier. It's all destroyed in peripheral tissue. So you have to use this kind of Trojan horse approach. And I was very fortunate in that I was one of the very first British doctors to be able to use L-DOPA. I was a very young intern at that time. And the effects were really, I mean, this is an overhyped word now, but the effects were really miraculous. I mean, people who had been given a death sentence of Parkinson's disease, who were confined to wheelchairs, unable to move or speak, were literally reawakened and resurrected with L-DOPA. So it was the idea that a disease that had rotted your brain could be corrected by an amino acid was really quite revolutionary at that time. And of course, this was the exciting area to be in. So it's a bit like molecular biology today. So this is where many young neurologists were drawn into that, including myself. And at that time, we felt we'd crack everything. You know, we thought we'd have a chemical replacement for Alzheimer's disease, which hasn't proved to be the case. We thought we'd crack Lou Gehrig's disease. We haven't managed to do that. And 50 years on, as I come to the end of my career, I'm still telling patients that L-DOPA is the best treatment for Parkinson's disease. So in that sense, when I compare my career with, for example, cardiologists, where there have been amazing transformations of care in cardiology, or even in AIDS, or even in oncology, we've not done a very good job. So, you know, I have patients now coming to see me who say, "Oh, Professor Lees, you treated my father, and he had Parkinson's disease with L-DOPA. Surely you've got something better than L-DOPA to offer me." And we haven't, in all honesty. So, you know, this in a sense has been a disappointment. But I think it's important to say that this is a very, very effective drug. So the bar the bar is very high. So to get a drug better than L-DOPA is quite difficult. And I think that's, of course, one of the reasons why we haven't made more progress, is because compared with other diseases like multiple sclerosis, Alzheimer's, and so on, the bar is very high. We have a very, very good treatment, which people with Alzheimer's, if we could offer something similar to people with Alzheimer's disease, and multiple sclerosis, it would really transform their lives. So it is a very effective treatment, but it's not a cure, and people get complications from the treatment, and the disease continues to get slowly worse. So it's not stopping the disease progressing; it's controlling and masking the symptoms.
Right. L-DOPA seemed to be, you know, as you said, an almost miraculous treatment for Parkinson's, but it did come with some downsides as well, such as the on-off switch patients experience while using the drug. This caused you to research both deprenil and bromocriptine as treatments for Parkinson's as well. Can you please tell us a bit about your journey with researching those two drugs?
These were the first adjuvant treatments that were introduced into clinical practice to help us alongside L-DOPA. I should say that although I was fortunate in that both of them, I was still a very young researcher and a young doctor, and I was fortunate in that both were translated into clinical practice. You know, many of the young doctors working today do research on drugs which never come through into clinical practice. There's a massive dropout, so that less than 20% of drugs that are in the pipeline and which are tested on patients never get into clinical practice. So I was really lucky that both the first two drugs I tried, that's to say bromocriptine and deprenyl, before they were available clinically, actually came into clinical practice. So bromocriptine is a drug which structurally is very like LSD, which is interesting. And it was marketed by Sandoz. And it was at Sandoz where Albert Hofmann, while working on ergot alkaloids, by chance discovered the psychedelic properties of LSD. So bromocriptine is not very different in its structure from LSD, which of course meant that when it was first introduced as a possible treatment for Parkinson's disease, we were all a little bit concerned that it might have similar psychiatric effects. And in fact, it can cause hallucinations, but not very often. And many patients, thousands of patients, have benefited from its use. I think, apart from trialing it and developing experience in doing clinical trials, I think that also helped me in the sense that I realized that there was quite a lot of interplay between psychopharmacology and the treatment of mental illness and the treatment of Parkinson's disease. And LSD actually is, everybody knows about its effect on serotonin. So it's a powerful stimulator of serotonin receptors, but it also stimulates dopamine receptors too. So in theory, in small doses, LSD might actually be an interesting trial drug to consider even now for Parkinson's disease. But we use this very similar drug called bromocriptine. Now, the lessons I learned from the other drug, deprenyl, which is a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, that these drugs had been used in depression, non-selective monoamine oxidase inhibitors, but they'd fallen out of favor because they had a lot of side effects, particularly a thing called a cheese effect, which is if you eat foods containing tyramine, including cheese, you would get catastrophic rises in blood pressure. So that psychiatrists, although they were very effective in helping people with depression, had become wary of using them, and newer drugs had become available. But this group of drugs breaks down, prevents the breakdown of dopamine in the brain, so that if you haven't got enough dopamine, you can enhance what you've got left by using monoamine oxidase inhibitors. And deprenyl was the first of a new type of monoamine oxidase inhibitor, a selective type that you could use safely without dietary restriction and also without in combination with L-DOPA therapy. So we were the very, very first people to test it. And one of my colleagues from the chemistry department smuggled some white powder through Heathrow Airport in a plastic bag in his raincoat. I mean, can you imagine doing that today? I mean, this was in the 70s. And I mean, he could have been arrested, I suppose. And it's just to kind of paint the picture a little bit for younger people listening to this of how different the 70s and 80s were as a milieu for doing research than today. We had enormous freedom and self-experimentation was encouraged. And the first thing we did was take this stuff ourselves. I mean, this was not considered to be bravado or cavalier. This was considered a very ethical thing to do. You know, there was a new compound. We didn't quite know what it was or what it would do to people. And in those days, it was encouraged, you know, to do it in controlled situations, obviously, but to test it on yourself. So Burroughs, of course, helped me with that because he was the arch self-experimenter. And he spoke to me and said, you must test this on yourself. Don't believe what anybody else is telling you about this. You must test it yourself. So those were different lessons I learned from those two different drugs that we were amongst the earliest investigators to test and go on to test in patients with Parkinson's disease.
Burroughs had lifelong issues with substance abuse. At one point, his parents sent him to England for treatment for his synthetic opioid addiction. He came under the care of a Dr. Dent, a practitioner who had gained a reputation for treatment of chronic anxiety and alcohol dependence. Can you please discuss this with us and talk about Burroughs' experience with apomorphine, as well as, you know, what inspired you to test apomorphine as a treatment for Parkinson's?
Yes, Burroughs had learnt somewhere along the line, probably from a friend, while he was in Tangiers in the interzone and badly hooked on synthetic opioids. And I think in risk of his life, quite frankly, I think he realised he was in trouble. And he'd already tried the dope farm in Lexington, Kentucky, and found it useless. And he'd tried many detox approaches in different parts of the world without success. But he'd heard about John Dent, who was a private physician working in London using apomorphine. Now, apomorphine had despite the name, it's not a narcotic, although it is synthesized from morphine. So you mix morphine with hydrochloric acid, and you get apomorphine. But in contrast to morphine, it doesn't have narcotic properties. And it had been used for many years as an aversive emetic in medicine, so that in people who had poisoned themselves, it was used to make them vomit to get rid of the poison. So it wasn't a new drug at all. But what was new about Dent's use of what Burroughs called the junk vaccine, he called apomorphine the junk vaccine, was that Dent believed that it wasn't working in the treatment of alcoholism and substance dependence just as an aversive sort of Pavlovian therapy. It actually had metabolic effects on the back brain, so that it actually was having chemical effects which, in a sense, were resetting the brain and curing it of its addictive potential. And this was quite an advanced hypothesis, because if you remember, this was in the 50s and it was before the chemical revolution had occurred. So nobody had any idea at that time that apomorphine was a dopamine agonist. This was only discovered in 1967. So this theory was developed long before one really knew what the drug did. And Burroughs went to see Dent. He was admitted to a clinic in London, and he responded very well. He came off junk. He stayed off junk for a while. He relapsed briefly once and was re-treated with apomorphine briefly, so he needed a top-up course. And he became a rather dubious champion for apomorphine in the States, raging against the Narcotics Bureau, raging against Kentucky, Lexington, Kentucky, saying that nobody was prepared to do trials with apomorphine, which he considered to be by far and away the most effective treatment for substance dependence. At that time, apomorphine was considered a Schedule II drug in the States, which means that it's a drug with strong addictive potential, although actually the evidence that it can be addictive is negligible. So I think that this, and it's no longer a Schedule II drug, it's been recategorized, but I think that held it back. When Burroughs championing it also held it back, because people really didn't pay much attention to junkies at that point, at least in the scientific world. They were felt to be rather unreliable in what they had to say. But in contrast to all the other doctors, or as Burroughs, to use Burroughs' word, he used to call doctors croakers. He got on incredibly well with Dent. They were both very interested in Mayan civilizations. They talked about control systems. But Dent was anti-establishment too, and could see the iniquities and the control systems within medicine and in the drug companies as well, but also within the establishment of medicine. And they hit it off, and they got on very, very well with one another. And of course, in a sense, this reduced the impact of Burroughs' cure, because people often said, oh, well, it was because Dent had a holistic approach. The two of them got on very well. Dent was also quite a charismatic character. And they attributed much of his success in treating alcoholics to his complementary therapy, if you like, in addition to the apomorphine. But and the use of apomorphine, which was already restricted to a few mavericks throughout Europe, gradually dwindled away. And this was really quite surprising to me, because as its use dwindled away, the evidence that it might be an interesting treatment to re-examine, not just in Parkinson's disease, but also in substance dependence and addiction, was growing and growing. So, for example, by the 80s, it was well established that dopamine systems controlled pleasure and reward pathways. Many drug addiction specialists believe that the dopamine pathway in one area of the brain was the final common pathway for addictive processes, which made it much more logical for apomorphine to be at least considered and retrialed with modern trial methodologies. But nothing happened. And it wasn't until really the 80s, when we were desperately looking around for better ways of treating, as you've talked about, Jeremy, the on-off effects. These were capricious peaks and troughs, roller coaster rides that patients were having on L-DOPA. So that as one continued with treatment over the years, the effects continued, but they were less reliable. So that patients began to notice that they were becoming immune to the drug, or they were becoming tolerant to the drug. But in fact, what was happening is that the delivery of the drug to the brain and changes within the receptors in the brain were compromising the continuous, consistent response to the drug, and it was becoming more patchy and brittle. And this was the major challenge for us in Parkinson's disease in the 80s. So I was, like many others, was looking around for options to try and treat this. And one night I continued to read Burroughs. So, and in The Naked Lunch, there is an appendix in which Burroughs describes his experiences with apomorphine and its effects and so on. But I also had a dream in which I saw some structural molecules, and one of these molecules was apomorphine. I was sitting at the bottom of the sea, and these sort of diatom-like, plankton-like molecules were swimming past me, and one of them was apomorphine. And I think this, plus a rereading of Naked Lunch, directed me to, and by that stage, we all knew that apomorphine was a dopamine stimulator, directed me towards apomorphine. Now, at that time, no pharmaceutical company was manufacturing it. It was a mature product. There was no money in it. Everybody had lost interest in it. But I decided to pursue it. And I thank Burroughs for that, because looking back now on my career, which has been a reasonably good one, as you kindly mentioned in your introduction, the thing I'm most proud of is the reintroduction of apomorphine into clinical practice, because this is the only thing I've done which has had a direct impact on patients' welfare and well-being. It's transformed the lives of hundreds of patients by helping to correct the on-off effect. And I, you know, Burroughs deserves a footnote of recognition for that. And I suppose, in a sense, that was another reason I wanted to write the book, just to recognize his contribution to that.
Burroughs at one point traveled to the Amazon and experimented with the hallucinogen yahe, or ayahuasca. That inspired you to go there and experiment as well. Can you please discuss how his journey inspired yours and what your experience was like, as well as what potential medical benefits the drug may have?
Yes, well, although I'd been offered psychedelic drugs in my teens and early 20s at medical school, I'd always been too frightened to take them, and I'd restricted myself to a bit of cannabis and hash. But as we've already talked, I was always interested in psychedelic drugs and this link with serotonin and dopamine, which came through bromocriptine, had kept them in focus in that sense. But they were not part of my everyday medical practice. But as I got into my 60s, I began to feel that I was running very much out of ideas. And I was aware, actually, that I was becoming much more rigid in my thinking. You know, I wasn't opening my mind to things, partly because Parkinson's, the literature in Parkinson's was so all-embracing. And it was taking me more and more time to just keep up to date with that. I felt I was beginning to think I hadn't got anything else new to contribute. So I think it was on that background that when I went to a medical conference in Colombia, and visited Leticia, which is in the Colombian Amazon, and had the opportunity to, with a friend, to experience, to be offered ayahuasca, that I decided that I might take it. Now, of course, it's very fashionable to do it now, and there's plane loads of people going down from Silicon Valley to Iquitos to do it. Right. So I kind of feel almost ashamed to talk about it, because it's become so naff. You know, everybody's doing it now. I can imagine they'll be serving it in Starbucks soon. But the links with, you know, actually that, you know, I'm keep sidetracking a little, but you know, the links between psychedelics and Silicon Valley is a fascinating story. Of course, Steve Jobs came out and talked about the importance of LSD to him. But the beginning of Silicon Valley is very linked up with psychedelic use in San Francisco in the 60s, if you research it. But that's a story anyway for a different day. So I feel that I had a positive experience with ayahuasca or yahe, which, as you say, Burroughs took when he was a young man. I think, but Burroughs took yahe really to exorcise what he called the ugly spirit, which he felt had invaded him after he'd shot, in a bizarre William Tell accident, his common law wife in Mexico City, and he'd managed to get off on manslaughter. But he was in a pretty low state. He was hooked on drugs, so he may have hoped that yahe may have got him off drugs too. But I was kind of more attracted to doing it really to see if it would open up my mind and get rid of some of these very rigid structures, which I think academia can bring, really, because we're so, and it's got worse now, because I mean, we're spending all our time writing grants, dealing with IRBs in universities, the administrative burden, and so on. And I do think that it opened up new vistas for me and helped me to challenge authority more and do really what I wanted to do more than what I felt I had to do. So in that sense, it was a positive experience for me. I'm not sure if I'll ever take any other psychedelic drugs. I might, but I don't feel driven to keep taking them.
Andrew, I've taken up a lot of your time today. My final question for you is, what are you working on now?
We're trying to develop an oral junk vaccine is one thing. So that one of the problems, we've talked a lot about apomorphine. One of the problems for everyday practice is that this drug has to be injected under the skin like insulin. So what we're trying to do with it, and I'm working with a medicinal chemist at Harvard, is to, he has designed several drugs which look like apomorphine and will hopefully have the same effects, but which can be given by mouth. Now, if we can get a long-acting, powerful oral apomorphine, this would be much more palatable for trials in drug addiction and substance dependence, and also would be useful in Parkinson's disease too. So that's one thing I'm doing. The other thing I'm doing, which I mentioned in the last chapter of the book, is I'm trying to reinvestigate the possibility that one of the ingredients of ayahuasca, sometimes called the devil's vine, Banisteria carpi, which contains a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, might actually be therapeutic for Parkinson's disease. So we've done trials. You can't just do what we did in the 80s anymore. You've got to go through a program of preclinical trials with animals and so on. So we've done quite a lot of the animal work, and I'm hoping this year that we'll be able to do a small pilot study with Banisteriopsis carpi in people with Parkinson's disease. So this is, I suppose, these two developments are two developments that really, I think, stem directly out of my personal ayahuasca experience in six years ago now.
That sounds great. I want to thank you again for being on the show today. It was an honor to talk to you and an absolute pleasure. Take care.
Thanks, Jeremy.